It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Suicide bombers attack a Tripoli hotel, killing at least 9 people. At least 9 killed Tuesday in an attack on a Tripoli hotel popular with politicians and international visitors. 5 of the dead foreigners, including an American. According to Libyan authorities, the gunman set off a car bomb outside the Carinthi Hotel before storming the building and opening fire with weapons. The attackers blew themselves up. A group calling itself the Tripoli Province of the Islamic State claimed responsibility. Malawi's President Peter Mutharika has appealed for relief aid after declaring more than half his country's districts disaster areas, as hundreds of thousands have been displaced by heavy rains and flooding.
I appeal for humanitarian assistance, the international donor community, the relevant non-nation agencies, the non-government organizations, the local public sector, as well as all fellow citizens of goodwill, so that together we can contribute in alleviating suffering on the part of people affected by the floods.
More than 170 have died. Some 600,000 have been displaced by week-long torrential downpours. The World Food Program is among several international organizations offering relief assistance. Meanwhile, nearly 70 have died from a tropical storm that battered Madagascar a week ago, many killed by landslides. It comes as the country grapples with a plague that has killed nearly 60 out of more than 230 known cases. 3 people were killed Tuesday during violent protests in northern Mali near a UN base. The protesters descended on the base, throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails. The UN insists its troops fired only warning shots, the unrest following a proposal to create a buffer zone that some favors Tuareg separatists. This is VOA News. The leader of Yemen's Shia Houthi rebels has called for a peaceful transfer of power. In an appearance Tuesday on the rebels' television station, Abdel Malik al-Houthi said he invites all free and honorable people to what he called a large, inclusive, and historic meeting Friday in the capital, Sana'a. At U.S. Defense Headquarters of the Pentagon Tuesday, U.S. Defense spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby said the U.S. is in contact with the Houthis.
As a participant in this process, it is a fact, and it has to be assumed, that Houthis will have reason to and will want to have discussions with the international community about the way forward. The U.S. government is participating in those discussions. I'm not going to go into any more detail than that.
The Houthi rebels emerged as the dominant group among those who've wrestled for power since a 2012 popular uprising toppled longtime leader Ali Abdullah Saleh. The rebels freed a presidential aide hours before the speech on Tuesday. The rebels abducted him from his car, setting off fighting between rebels and presidential guards and forcing the president and his government to resign. An economist who has been an outspoken critic of Greece's bailout deal with international lenders was named Tuesday as the country's finance minister in the new leftist government. Anti-austerity Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras picked Yanis Varoufakis for the key economic portfolio, as he named other political supporters to his cabinet. Varoufakis, who holds dual Greek and Australian citizenship, will now play an important role in Athens' negotiations with its lenders. Greece is seeking to eliminate some of the massive debt and ease austerity measures the creditors forced on the country in exchange for billions in bailouts. He spoke with reporters Tuesday.
You are an expert in game theory. How is that going to help you run the economy?
Bargaining is a big game, and we're about to begin negotiating with our partners and deliberating, actually.
And are you excited about being able to put your theories into political practice? Is that the big challenge now?
It is a great challenge. But the challenge is how to minimize social costs that were unnecessary throughout Europe.
In the immediate hours after Syriza's victory Sunday, European leaders took a tough stance against Greece, demanding that it keep its financial commitments to pay back loans and keep in place pension and wage cuts and other austerity measures if it wants to remain in the 19-nation euro currency bloc. The leader of the Eurozone's finance ministers said he'll visit Athens Friday to meet with the new Greek leadership. Ukraine's parliament approved a statement Tuesday labeling Russia an aggressor state, while European Union leaders threatened to widen sanctions against Moscow for continuing to back separatists in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's lawmakers also voted to designate the Russian-backed separatist so-called People's Republics in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk and Luhansk regions terrorist organizations. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union signs a substantive transport deal with China.
This is really the most substantive project the AU has ever had with any partner.
Nkosi Zana Dlamini Zuma is chairperson of the African Union Commission. We'll have analysis of Zimbabwe President Mugabe's possible election this week as African Union chairman. Millions of displaced Nigerians struggle with daily existence. Somalia aims to improve the lives of its children. And the losing candidate in last week's presidential election in Zambia calls for electoral reforms.
The issue is that we need the electoral reform that do not allow the Electoral Commission, who is the referee, but acts as a scorer when there's no goalkeeper in the court. That's what the Electoral Commission of Zambia staff were doing, non-stop.
Hakainde Hichilema is leader of Zambia's opposition, United Party for National Development. And a Sierra Leone Harvard Business School student starts a fashion magazine in Sierra Leone. Those stories, plus Mark Oman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union and China on Tuesday signed a memorandum of understanding that the Chinese are dubbing the project of the century. The deal aims to develop road, rail, and air transport routes to link African capitals. Sandra Nyaira of VOA Zimbabwe Service has the details from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
The African Union Commission Chairperson, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, and Mr. Zhang Ming, the Special Envoy of the Chinese Government and Vice Foreign Minister of China, signed the memorandum that will see China help Africa develop high-speed rail, linking all 54 countries through high-speed railway, aviation, road highways, and industrialization infrastructure. Dlamini Zuma said, although there are some historical ties between Africa and China, this mammoth project is the first of its kind between China and Africa at continental level. She said it will help Africans develop and deal with issues of joblessness, poverty, and related issues.
Amongst the things we've agreed on is also to train so that we have the skills both to deal with all the areas. So this is really the most substantive project the AU has ever had with any partner.
Mr. Zhang dubbed the Memorandum of Understanding the document of the century, adding, though ambitious and broad, the project was feasible. He said it would change the face of Africa, especially as economies in most African countries continue to improve. In aviation, for example, Mr. Zhang said travel hubs will be created, cutting the existing code that sees Africans traveling within the continent having to go to the West first to catch connecting flights back to Africa.
I still remember during a meeting between my premier and Madame Zuma. Madame Zuma mentioned that the African people have a dream of having the day when all the 54 African capitals will be linked by high-speed rail.
The two refused to quantify the cost of the project, but Dlamini Zuma said teams on the ground were still to come up with a figure, working out financing modalities and related issues. Meanwhile, the AU chairperson, in outlining the AU summit agenda to journalists, said one of the most important issues outside terrorism, conflict in a number of countries, and peace and security that heads of state will discuss this week is the funding of the Pan-African body. The AU needs more predictable funding from member states in addition to what is coming in from donor organizations. Reporting from Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, I'm Sandra Nyaira.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is poised to assume the chairmanship of the African Union at the completion of the body's 24th summit, which is underway in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. President Mugabe is also currently the chairman of the Southern African Development Community, NUASADC. Independent political analyst Blessing Vava says the position will distract Mr. Mugabe from pressing issues in the country.
It's a lot on President Mugabe's table, but as you know that President Mugabe is not very much worried about what is happening in Zimbabwe, you know, for a fact that he's just coming from a holiday. A holiday that he went, what is the people of Zimbabwe are facing a lot of economic challenges. And also his party, ZANU-PF, is facing a lot of challenges. So that on its own shows you that this is not a man who's really serious in tackling the issues that are affecting his country. And now that he's assuming the African Union chairpersonship and is also the chairperson of SADC, it says a lot of a man who really does not mind about solving his problems that is at home, but is very much worried about globe-trotting, flying away from this country.
That was independent political analyst Blessing Vava speaking from Harare with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service. But former Zimbabwe cabinet minister and ruling ZANU-PF Politburo member Munyawazi Paul Magwana says President Mugabe is the most capable person to be the next chairman of the African Union.
I think President Mugabe is the most suitable person to lead both SADC and Africa at this point in time. He has got a wealth of experience in dealing with challenges. He has been in power for over 30 years. He led the War of Liberation. He understands the challenges any African country can face, both politically and economically, and is best suited to give guidance. Apparently, when he's chairman of SADC, he's not a full-time employee of SADC. When he's chairman of the AU, he's not a full-time employee of the AU. There are structures which have been put in place. What he needs to give is simply guidance on how to resolve any challenges which may face SADC as a region and the AU as a continent. I do not think you have a problem at all. The experienced people running structures in SADC, in the AU is being led by a very competent diplomat in the form of Madam Gosazana Zuma, and she's able to steer Africa while she's getting political guidance in terms of decision-making from the most experienced politician on this earth, President Mugabe.
Munyawazi Paul Magwana is a former Zimbabwe cabinet minister and ZANU-PF Politburo member. He was speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service. The man who came second in last week's Zambian special presidential election says the country needs a new constitution that will produce a truly independent electoral commission. Hakainde Hichilema of the opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, says the current electoral commission serves the interests of the ruling Patriotic Front Party because its members are appointed by the president. The election commission said ruling party candidate Edgar Lungu won 48.3% of the vote, while Hichilema finished second with 46.7%. But Hichilema said the election was stolen from him.
What happened is that we won the election, the vote was stolen from us. It's very clear that the manipulation of the election results was not just in the polling stations. It was also in the constituent totaling centers. Worse still, it was in the national tallying center under the nose of the electoral commission.
So do you think that the people of Zambia bought your message?
Absolutely. And I thank the people of Zambia. They bought our message. We had the clearest message. We reached out to the people more than any other candidate. Our campaign was extremely organized, well organized, and it's acknowledged by everybody else. So you can see from the results we got, even when they were stealing our results, transposing our results. I mean, they allocate my results, which are higher, to Lungu, my competitor, and we discovered that we made that known to the Electoral Commission, and the Electoral Commission of Zambia admitted that that had happened.
I read an article quoted the other presidential candidate, Edith Nawakwe, saying that the UPND risks losing votes and support from other regions of Zambia if it continues using tribe as a platform for doing politics. What do you make of that?
That's not the issue. We are victims of ethnic segregation. We are victims of ethnic segregation and marginalization. The country is not about tribe. It's not about ethnicity. The country and our agenda, and that's the message we sold, is about economic turnaround, supporting businesses to survive, not just to survive, but to grow. And when they grow, we create jobs. That's our message. That's why we won this election. I originate from Southern Province. We won in Northwestern Province. We won in Western Province. We won in Central Province. We won in Southern Province. We won in Lusaka Rural. We won in Coppabelle Rural. We won seats in Eastern Province. Wherever we didn't win, we were number two everywhere across the country. So what is she talking about? Where is the tribal issue? Where is the ethnicity? Zambia doesn't need tribe. It needs competent team, a competent team to turn around the economy.
My question is, do you intend to run again for president?
The people of Zambia will decide. My party will decide. Our National Management Committee will decide. The issue is that we need the electoral reforms that do not allow the Electoral Commission, who is a referee, but acts as a scorer when there's no goalkeeper in the goal. We also want certain things to be done in the way results are declared. It's also, we need to have an independent electoral commission, a truly independent electoral commission, which is not what we have now. Because what we have now, the returning officer for presidential results is the Chief Justice, who is appointed by the ruling party.
Hakainde Hichilema is the leader of Zambia's opposition United Party for National Development. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Today is Wednesday, January 28th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. This month, Somalia's president signed into law the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Somali children continue to face daily challenges posed by conflict, displacement, malnutrition, and disease. One in seven died before reaching the age of five, and fewer than half of the children attend school. Abdulaziz Bello reports from Mogadishu on what, if any, this new law will do to help improve the lives of the Somali child.
Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud officially ratified the Convention on the Rights of Children at a ceremony held in a Mogadishu school. Somalia is the 195th state party to sign the document.
We want our children to be leaders who can take on national and international responsibilities. Some of the children in front of me today will be among the leaders that take responsibility for the Somali nation and the world as well.
The convention articulates a set of universal rights to protect children. Among them is right to life, survival, and development. Decades of conflict in the East African nation have raised its child and maternal mortality rates to among the worst in the world. But with the recent signing, the United Nations Children's Fund has expressed hope that in the near future, Somalia's government will be in a position to protect its own children.
UNICEF looks forward to working with the government to implement this convention and work towards achieving key results on the protection of children's rights within the next 2 years. The next 2 years are actually key, because as the government will be submitting the first progress report on the implementation of this convention.
According to UN figures, one in seven Somali children die before reaching the age of five, mostly from preventable illnesses, and only four in ten children are in school. Human rights activists in Mogadishu welcomed the signing as a positive step. Amina Arale of the Somali Women Development Center says the Somali government will now be held accountable for any violation against children.
It's the responsibility of the government to ensure the rights of the children are protected. By signing the agreement, the government can be held accountable on any crime committed on children at the courts. The Somali children have a golden opportunity and will have the rights protected.
Although implementing the accord will take time, the government says it will now work on drafting and adopting child-friendly policies and systems, implement measures to boost child survival, development, participation and protection, and provide regular reports on its progress to the UN's Committee on the Rights of the Child. Abdulaziz Bilo for VOA News, Mogadishu.
More than 3 million people have been displaced in Nigeria, many of them fleeing the violent five-year Boko Haram insurgency. Some have taken refuge in the capital, Abuja, but many say they receive little to no assistance from the government. Katarina Hoyer spent time with one of the displaced men and his family and has this report on the daily struggle to support his young family in Abuja.
It's Friday morning at the busy car park in the Garki neighborhood in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. On the roadside, next to the small shops that sell biscuits, sweetened drinks, and phone recharge cards, passengers wait for taxis to take them to destinations all over the capital. Cruising in and out between the battered cars is Prince Bala. He came to Abuja 5 months ago after Boko Haram insurgents attacked Gosa, his hometown in the northeastern part of the country.
My coming here, it is just an emergency. I don't know that really I can find myself here. That's why I say, okay, as I come to Abuja, no more documents, because I left them in the village. So for me to just stay like this without any work, make a join this work. That's how I feel.
At the car park, he helps fill up the taxis with passengers headed to the same locations. Four people squeeze into the vehicle, each one paying for their own seat before it takes off. The drivers pay Prince Bala and the other young men. There are several of them working shifts here at the taxi rank between 20 and 30 naira, or about 10 to 15 cents.
When we finish, we will get something like 1,003 or 1,004. We will share it among ourselves.
Since he arrived in Abuja, Prince Bala has gotten little or no help from the government.
The government has not taken any more action about us. I don't know the reason why, but we even complain to them, write a letter to them, but they never even respond upon our.
The government acknowledges more than 1 million people were displaced in 2014 alone due to the fight against an intensified Boko Haram insurgency. Charity and humanitarian groups suspect the real numbers may be higher, but it is hard to get accurate accounts in the chaos. Thousands have flooded into Abuja in recent months. They end up living in informal settlements and are again not counted in official statistics. Wooden stalls line the gravel road leading to the building where Prince Bala, his wife Haliata, and the couple's two-week-old daughter live with others who fled Borno State. They are all struggling to get by, but Bala says they help each other. The refugees have set up an informal charity, dividing whatever they earn among themselves. Food is more expensive than in Gosa, and finding clean drinking water is difficult. The insurgents still control Gosa and continue to take new territory in the northeast. Borno State capital, Maiduguri, with 2 million residents, remains under siege. As the attacks and fighting continue, Prince Bala says he has no choice but to stay in Abuja with his family. Until then, daily life in the capital remains a struggle. This is Katerina Höye for VOA News in Abuja.
Nick Askill's family fled Sierra Leone in 1997 during the Civil War, but when she moved back a few years ago, Askill could not find a good resource to help her learn more about the country's vibrant fashion and culture. So she started her own resource, Evoke Magazine. The publication recently launched a new digital platform that she hopes will help it grow into a regional resource. Askill, a business school student at Harvard, talks to Ricky Stryak about starting a magazine in Sierra Leone and why, especially in the time of an Ebola crisis, the region needs to continue exploring its culture.
Right now, Evoke has a print portion and also a digital platform. So on the print side, as you know, like globally, print is quote-unquote dying. In this part of the world, we face the challenge where it's still more alive than the rest of the world. So trying to balance out that print strategy with that digital platform is a challenge, because while some people are moving away from print, a large population is still relying on print, and the mobile penetration is quite low. And the smartphone penetration on top of that is also relatively low. So trying to balance out the two channels has been a challenge over the last year or so.
Do you think there are certain advantages to being a West African publication?
I think the potential lies in our value proposition of being cross-border, so incorporating a diverse content from different countries. Most of the magazines people are aware of, the locally bred, the African bred magazines, most of them tend to be country specific. If we can get our value proposition across and cross that bridge between the different countries, I think there's a huge potential there.
As someone whose family left during the war and now you're connecting with Sierra Leone. Are you part of a generation that's trying to do that?
I definitely believe that there's my part of generation is quote unquote what I like to call quote unquote the lost generation. But a lot of us are moving back to Sierra Leone. I know quite a few of my friends that I went to primary school with that have relocated back to Sierra Leone. The unique view comes from having a two-world perspective, if you will. Like, so having this quote-unquote Western world experience from living in the States for over a decade, and also the experience of being from Sierra Leone offers a unique lens to some of the issues that are there and some of the problems. And I think it can offer some innovative solutions going forward.
Right now, obviously, the biggest story in Sierra Leone is Ebola. And how difficult is it to try and still talk about the fashion, the culture, the music that goes on in Sierra Leone when so much of the focus internationally, anyway, at least, seems to be on Ebola? Do you think it's important to keep on stressing the fact that there's other aspects of life continuing, obviously, in the country?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely important. It's essential. Quite to my dismay, actually, traveling around quite a bit, you know, the first thing people tend to say when you tell them you're from Sierra Leone is obviously they mention Ebola, which has been splashed all over the news for the last few months. And while it is very, very important, it's a very important topic that needs to be addressed, there's life that's going on beyond Ebola.
I was Nick Askill, founder of Evoke magazine. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Boston. Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsoring here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on the Orange African Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. Goals scored in each half by Riaz Mahrez and Nabil Bentaleb propelled Algeria to a 2-0 triumph over Senegal in Malabo on Tuesday. Elsewhere, Mandla Masango scored in the first half before John Boy and Dede Ayew replied in the second half to hand Ghana a 2-1 victory over South Africa in the other Group C match in Mongomo. As a result, Ghana and Algeria tie on 6 points. Ghana topped the group, having prevailed over Algeria in their preliminary. Senegal has 4 points, while South Africa has one. Ghana and Algeria advanced to the quarterfinals. Meanwhile, Ghana captain Asamoah Gyan explains the secret behind their success. He congratulates his teammates.
First of all, I'd like to thank Almighty God. Secondly, I would thank the players and everybody, the Ghanaian team, everybody for their heart out. The key of this victory is mentally toughness. We are very, very strong mentally, despite everything. The boy kept on fighting, and at the end of the day, everybody saw the result. It happened against Algeria, and today that's happen again. So I'd like to thank everybody for their support. Yeah, honestly, we were thinking about our results. You know, we came here to win, and we didn't want to depend on anybody. We just needed to win and secure our quarterfinal dream, and that is what everybody saw today. It's really, really important, very, very important win for us, and I'd like to thank all the players for their fight today.
Thank you. That was Asamoah Gyan, the Ghana Black Stars captain, speaking in Mongomo. Still in Mongomo, South African coach Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba gave a frank assessment of his team's performance. He begins with the positives.
We've got the ability to score a goal, but the problem, we can't consolidate, keep that goal. After we score a goal, we sit back. But I think the boys did very well. For them to have managed to score a goal and score first, I think it was a good thing. But most unfortunately, we are not sharper in this game. We are not quick off the mark. We allowed them again to dictate the game, sweep and then run onto position. And one danger thing that we've done, we allowed them to force our two central defenders on a one-on-one situation. And they're too strong.
That was Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba, South African coach, speaking in Mongomo. Finally, Cameroon play Ivory Coast in Malabo as Guinea engage Mali in Mongomo in the last preliminary round fixtures today, Wednesday. These Group D sides are deadlocked, having played two draws with identical scorelines of 1-0. All teams know that nothing short of an outright victory guarantees a place in the quarterfinals. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a very good day. That's it for this Wednesday, January 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Owoman, I'm James Barty in Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Zambians have elected their next president following the sudden death of Michael Sata. We'll discuss the results and the copper-producing nation's future next time on VOA Africa.
Celebrate
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.